The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
There is seriously stiff competition tonight for talks. I want to be in about three others, so thank you for coming to this one. I probably would be good just talking here, but I have a PowerPoint that I wanted to show you because it has amazing pictures. But since I can't show you, I still need it to follow my own logic through this talk, so that's why I'm going to stand up here. So I think what I want to do is kind of begin not with Attica, but to kind of lay the groundwork for what I think probably brings us here in addition to Attica, which is the contemporary situation, the combination of living in the midst of one of the biggest carceral crises of really world history, certainly U.S. history, but I would say world history, but also living in the midst of a really extraordinary moment of prisoner activism and uprising that the likes of which we really have not seen since the late 60s and early 70s, and really trying to make sense of how both of these things connect, where they both came from, what might this mean for the next few years going forward. I think that an understanding of Attica is in some respects ground zero of that discussion. And of course I'm biased because I worked on this book for 13 years, so I'm gonna make it relevant even even if it's not. But I actually do think it's relevant. And what I'd love to do is to really just tell you a little bit about the story of Attica, the history of Attica, spend some time talking about that, in part because Attica is one of those events that everybody knows a little bit about. Some of us saw Eyes on the Prize and saw footage from Attica. Some of us remember Attica. Some of us have seen certainly snippets of important Attica speeches, but the actual story of Attica is very murky. And there's a good reason for that. I actually was so naive that I was a historian who thought that I was good. I first wrote about Detroit and about black politics in Detroit. That's where I come from, is Detroit. And then I thought, I'm going to do a book on the Attica prison uprising, not having any idea what that was going to mean. It was 13 years of my life, because this is a story that, simply put, the state of New York didn't want anyone to know, let alone to tell. Because this is a story of murder. It is a story of a cover-up of the highest order. And I don't say that lightly as a historian. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, even slightly. This is literally a factual statement about what happened after Attica. But it's also one of the most extraordinary human rights struggles in history. And those things together made it a very difficult story to tell, because in order to tell it with some measure of distance, it required getting access to documents that were simply off limits. I can tell you that the story of getting those documents was itself, I could do a book on doing the book, frankly. I probably could not have written this book were it not for two things. One, the extraordinary resilience of the survivors, the prisoners who kept telling their stories and kept telling their stories and kept telling their stories, and were willing to share their stories with me, also the lawyers and the judges. But also because I had a lucky break. There's no other way to put it. I happened upon a cache of documents which changed everything. It allowed me to name the shooters that killed people after 40 years who've been protected by the state. It allowed me to tell you what really happened. But that was a fluke. And that should scare all of us about what in our past we don't really know. So anyway, I'm getting a little off track already. This is why I need my PowerPoint. But needless to say, the reason why Attica is important is in part because it was important at the time and therefore kind of hidden from us. That's how important I think it really is. So really quickly, before I tell you that, I came to Attica before I even fully grasped the nature of this carceral crisis we're in. I started this book in 2004. And I was one of these people who were kind of noticing that all around us, everybody we knew were being locked up, everybody was being policed. But the thing about being part of something is you don't kind of realize what's happening, the bigger picture, right? Because it's happening as you're in the middle of it. I can remember being in high school and, you know, my friends were getting locked up and doing time. Like, but you don't know what's happening because you're kind of in the middle of it. And it wasn't until I was doing this book that I began to fully appreciate that something very significant had happened after 1970, very specifically, even more specifically after 1972. And what that was that we came to lock up more people than any other country on the planet. Prior to 1972, the prison rate in this country was remarkably stable. Crime rate goes like this, but the prison rate like this. After 1972, as we know, the prison rate goes through the roof. So as a historian, we have to explain that, right? And many of us do. There's lots of explanation. Now everyone's writing on this, but at the time, it was kind of this moment that we needed to understand. And, you know, as a leftist, as a historian, as a Detroiter, I knew that the answer was not the crime rate. And I knew that the answer had a lot to do with where the policing was and had to do with what the political response was to crime. So I knew all that, but I didn't quite fully understand what exactly had happened. Let's be clear, the actual war on crime had started in 1965 with Johnson, not Nixon, just to be clear. But it's not until 72 that we start not only locking everybody up, but we build the most punitive prison system in the country. Not just the most numerically large, but the most punitive. So it began to occur to me that something actually about Attica was really important to the story, and also it was really counterintuitive, right? How can something that's so important to prisoner rights rebellion turn into something so repressive? So that's kind of the background of the story I want to tell you. So fast forwarding to the story, let me just get to that really quickly. So Attica, anyone been to upstate New York? Anyone actually see Attica? Okay, so Attica's a tiny town in upstate New York, pretty near Buffalo, but it's minuscule. You drive through it, blink your eyes, you're out of it. You know, it looks like a painting of Norman Rockwell, little bandstand, nice little park, and you leave the town and there's this massive fortress, which is Attica. Attica was built during the Depression. It's still in operation. I can tell you it is, having spent more time in federal and state prisons than I care to admit. It is absolutely one of the most brutal prisons today. Worse today than it was in 1971. In 1971, it was filled with about 2,400 men, overwhelmingly black and brown men from big cities, from the New York City, the boroughs, from Buffalo, from Rochester, and it was overwhelmingly filled with white guards, small town kids, no jobs, often coming back from Vietnam themselves, looking for work. In this prison, conditions were brutal. Just to give you a flavor of it, these men are being fed on 63 cents a day. These are men locked up for, this is long before solitary, the way we know it today. These are men being locked up 23 hours a day, barely getting out of their cells. All the rules were capricious. The racial politics were horrendous in this prison, as you might imagine. And basically, everyone is trying to figure out a way to make this place a more humane institution, which we could talk later about camp prisons become more humane, but at least in this moment, people are imagining them to be humane. Why? Because in 1971, and it's hard for us to imagine, if you looked at polling data, most Americans, the majority of Americans, were against the death penalty. The majority of Americans had believed that prisons were warehouses. We needed to move towards community corrections. The courts were ruling in favor of prisoners in a record rate. And people believe that actually you could actually do something here. Maybe we could actually reform this behemoth that was the American prison system. And so there's two things going on. There's a real reformist impulse going on in the prisons, which people are writing their state senators, they're writing the commissioner of corrections, please help make this place more humane. And there's also a real revolutionary spirit also in the prison. The Panthers are there, the Weather Underground's there, the 5%ers are there. I mean, it's a real hodgepodge. People are reading Che, they're reading Marx, they're reading Lenin, they're reading everything, right? But in this moment, it is not a planned insurrection, believe it or not. In fact, what starts the Attica Rebellion is the prison management itself. The prison management, through one capricious action after another, obviously frustrates people, obviously it makes people more militant. But on the day of the uprising, which is September 9th, 1971, it was a really stupid managerial decision that touches this thing off. Basically, they make this decision to lock these guys in a hallway, to prevent them from going out to rec, to send them back to their cells. But they don't tell the guards why these doors are locked. They don't tell the prisoners why these doors are locked. And in this tense environment, there's utter panic ensues. And everyone's backing away from each other and grabbing anything they can to protect themselves. And in that chaotic, horrible moment, a gate manages to come open that is the nerve center of the prison because these people are trying to get out of this hallway. through this happenstance, you might imagine this is chaotic, it is dangerous, nobody knows what's going on, it is a brutal scene. One of the main guards, the nerve center of the prison, is overrun. He's beaten very, very badly. A lot of the prisoners are beaten, guards are beaten, prisoners are grabbing guards hostage, prisoners are locked, some of them are locking themselves in their cells because they're terrified of what this is all gonna mean. But in that moment, cooler heads kind of take over, prevail. Because the guys who'd been organizing in the yard had some stature, right? They had some credibility with the general population. And they basically said, we need to, wait, stop, right? We need to get everybody into one space. One space was D Yard. We have an extraordinary opportunity here to bring the world inside of Attica, to tell the world what it's like to be in one of these hell holes, who's in these hell holes, and to make people accountable for the system that they fund, support, right? Because think about it, even today, right? These are institutions that the American people rely on for their crime, for their safety, but they don't know anything about them, and they basically fund them with absolute faith that they are humane institutions. So they do. They move out to D-Yard. There's about 1,300 men that move out into D-Yard. And that begins one of the most extraordinary human rights struggles, I would say, really, throughout history. It's extraordinary because these guys essentially set up a democracy. It is a tent city. It is a democracy, the likes of which were just stunning to outsiders. They elected, each cell block elected representatives to speak for them out of the broader group to be representatives. There was many Spanish-speaking prisoners. Everybody at the front that gave speech, everything was translated into Spanish so that all prisoners could know what was going on. They immediately wanted the media to come in because, again, they understood the importance of eyes being on this. And I'm making this point for a reason, because we're going to come back to today at the end of this talk, which is about South Carolina, where I'm spending a lot of time. It's about the latest prison stuff going on. Eyes on it is critical. So they wanted the media's eyes on this. So there's every reporter is there. And they also want observers. And they want observers there to help oversee these negotiations because they don't trust the state. This is Rockefeller's state. This is Governor Rockefeller's state of New York. Liberal Republican, but they all don't trust him, right? They understand his racial politics. So they want these observers. So it's a interesting group. It's Tom Wicker from the New York Times. It's Bill Kunstler, because he was, known for the Chicago 8 and then Chicago 7. It was Clarence Jones, who was the editor of the Amsterdam News in Harlem. But the state also put its own people on this body, right? So there's Republican senators, there's a U.S. congressman, Herman Badillo from New York. This is a real hodgepodge group. But the one thing they all have in common is the conviction that this thing has got to be ended peacefully. And why are they so convinced of this? Well, there's two reasons. One, there are now 40 civilian and guard hostages inside of Attica that have been, interestingly, completely protected. Two groups of prisoners surrounded them, gave them mattresses, gave them food, made sure that they were protected, because of course they understand that these guards are all that stand between them and an invasion, and they have faith that the state cares enough about its employees that that's gonna matter, which is key to this. And they also, in addition to having 40 hostages in there, the observers can see what the prisoners cannot, which is that while this is going on, 4 long days and long nights of round-the-clock negotiations, and in this book I take you to, like, it's blow by blow, like you're there, right? Every state trooper battalion in the state of New York is descending on Attica. And every off-duty prison guard is descending on Attica. And they're showing up, and these guys are passing out weapons indiscriminately. Nobody's writing down serial numbers. In fact, this one hapless trooper who's trying to, like, keep track of who has what gun is basically told to rip it up. These guys are getting they're getting more and more angry by the hour, in part because the FBI is on the scene planting rumors that that the prisoners are committing all these atrocities inside, that they're forcing the hostages to stand at attention, and if they should falter, they'll shoot them in the head. Of course, the prisoners don't even have guns, right? But so they're fomenting this really kind of just frothing at the mouth fury on the part of the troopers. And meanwhile, the prisoners are trying to negotiate a settlement. So pretty much, almost all of the prisoner demands, which by the way are basic, you know, things like Spanish-speaking guards and humane parole rules and sufficient food. I mean, you know, again, this is not, these are not outlandish demands. And in the middle of these negotiations, the guard, remember I told you the one that got run over in the middle of that, kind of beaten in the middle of that, that he dies of his injuries. And this is a game changer, because then the prisoners understand at that moment that the most important demand is amnesty, right? In order for them to surrender, there has to be amnesty for having rebelled. And there has to be a judicious prosecution of this man's death, because as it stands, because of felony murder rules, every one of them could be on the hook for felony murder. So this is critical. They want amnesty from physical and legal reprisals. The observers beg for them to get this, for Rockefeller to give this. He says, hell no. Now we now know, again, I now know looking back on this from the documents, that he is not about to give amnesty. He wants to be the president. He was very irritated that Nixon had somehow gotten the presidency. He knew he had to show that he was righter to the right, to his own party, and Attica was going to be his line in the sand. There was no way he was going to negotiate with these guys. And contrary to all the things we heard a few years later, that they tried to negotiate it, they couldn't negotiate it, I now know that they had every intention of going in and taking this prison by force, despite the fact that things were going in the direction of settlement, because I found those documents. At the end of the day, this is a stalemate. But they don't tell the prisoners this. In fact, I found the document that indicated that it was a deliberate plan to make the prisoners think that negotiations were still in play. So on the fifth morning of this, it is raining, it is freezing, it is nasty. This is September, by the way, in upstate New York, and I don't have to tell you what that means. Like, this thing is falling apart just in terms of the climate, right? People want to give up. They want this thing to settle. And I don't, this is not to take away from the spirit of it. It's just to say, like, they had gotten most of the important demands. They were ready to give up. On that fifth morning, the state troopers are armed to the teeth. We now know that they began taking off their identifying badges. We know that they were actually going to go in a day and a half earlier, and the only reason they didn't was because there was one Republican state senator who was on the observers team who basically brokered this own deal to delay it one more day in the hope that something would resolve. And as these guys are getting up in the yard, they think negotiations are still going on. And so the state comes to, state officials come to the door, the gate, and they basically say the same thing they'd said every morning, right? Relinquish the hostages. This thing is over. They'd said that every day. And then prisoners basically said respectfully, no thank you. We're gonna still negotiate this. And as they finish this conversation, all of a sudden they can hear a helicopter revving up. And to show you kind of, again, the faith in humanity that the prisoners have, some of them think that Rockefeller's coming. They actually begged Rockefeller to come. That was the other thing, to talk, you know, assure them that they could surrender without being harmed. He said no. So they think Rockefeller's coming. So there's like a cheer that goes up in the yard, like finally we're going to be able to end this thing. And then they realize, wait a minute, no. We haven't seen the observers. This is not good. And that helicopter does a reconnaissance and leaves. And then absolute panic sets in. And it sets in because the hostages who had been interviewed by the media the night before had also begged Rockefeller to come, had also, they said, these guys are treating us well, they have justifiable demands. And they're getting scared because they know that, you know, if you all prisoners think that our lives matter, maybe not so much, right? So everybody's very scared. When that helicopter does reconnaissance and leaves, then all of a sudden it begins to dawn on people that this is a new day, that there's about ready to be some kind of an assault. And they still are so naive that they think the assault's going to be armed combat, right? Because everyone knows the prisoners don't have any guns. And every other prison riot that had ever been retaken, the guards come in with nightsticks. And it's not pretty, but people don't die. And right at that moment, when they realize this, they enact a plan, which is, it's just, you know, I wrote this book now 2 years ago. I still can get very emotional even when I read it myself. Because imagine the scene where the prisoners and the hostages alike, they've talked about this. They know that this might happen, and they have this plan. And it's an ill-fated plan, but it just shows you that this was something that they had, like, everyone's trying everything they can to imagine a solution to this. And they said, look, if we can't get this, if the state's going to come in, our last ditch plan is this. We're going to take some of the hostages out of the yard, and we're going to bring them up on these catwalks that surround, that overlay the yards. We're going to surround each one of them with a couple of the prisoners with these handmade weapons. So what are we talking about? We're talking about baseball bats, you know, handmade shivs, you know what I mean? Again, no firearms. And so that if the helicopter comes back over, we can, like, you know, hold them up. See, if you come in, right, you're killing your own. Like, don't do that, right? This is their last-ditched effort to keep the state out. And there's still this remote, fleeting faith that these working-class white kids are going to matter to the state officials. And I take you in the book up onto this catwalk, for example, where there is Mike Smith, who is this 24-year-old white kid. He's a guard, and he's the hostage that's surrounded by the so-called executioners. But to his right is this prisoner by the name of Don Noble, and they knew each other. They'd worked together in the metal shop. And I take you up there while they are up on this catwalk, and they are sick with fear. And they are sharing stories, and basically, you know, Mike is telling Don that I've got in my back pocket, I have a note, my wife's name is Sharon, and if I don't get out of here, and you do, can you please find her, tell her I love her, tell her what happened. And Don is telling Mike essentially, you know, his particulars. And right at that moment, as they are like literally quaking, and this is Mike Smith talking, he says, then a second helicopter came over, and this was a huge, massive, this is an Army helicopter. And he said, and it was so large and that the blades were so massive, he says, you could just feel the concussion in your chest. And right at that moment, the helicopters come over and they dump these canisters of CN and CS gas over the yards. Now, anybody ever experienced tear gas? So tear gas is a misnomer. We think of gas as gas. No, it's not gas. It's actually powder. That's what tear gas is. And in that concentrated space, they put this most toxic gas canisters that were exploding everywhere, which put this gas thick in the air, and it was getting in people's eyes, down their throats, up their nose. So everyone, and you can see this in the film, because by the way, the state police are filming all this. You can see the gas drop, and everybody is mowed down, just mowed down from the gas. And as they're vomiting and blinded and on the floor, that's when over 300 state troopers come out over the catwalks. And they are shooting. And they are shooting every weapon they have. They have rifles that they've never shot before. They have deer hunting rifles. They have ammunition outlawed by the Geneva Convention. They have their own personal weapons that they brought from under their beds. And in 15 minutes, it is a bloodbath. They are shooting people indiscriminately. They are kicking people off of the catwalk who have been shot, falling down 50 feet. And mind you, while this is all going on, there's a helicopter, the first surveillance helicopter, and it's going overhead, and there's someone on a megaphone saying, surrender with your hands up and you won't be harmed. Surrender with your hands up and you won't. And all you can hear is da-da-da-da-da-da-da while this is going on. So there are at this moment 39 dead men, a mixture of prisoners and hostages. But there's 128 men so severely shot, some of them 6, 7, 8 bullet wounds. And let's just pause here. I'm going to come back to this. So this is carnage. There are dead state employees in addition to prisoners. And and right up until this moment, the prisoners have had enormous support. I already told you about the polling. I already told you about where the nation is right now with regard to prisons and prison reform. State officials stand out in front of this prison And I told you every media outlet is there, right? Worldwide, by the way, not just nationally. And they tell the world that something totally different happened. They say the prisoners killed the hostages. They slit their throats. And not only that, these animals castrated one of the guards, shoved his testicles in his mouth, and the media is, I mean, they've been in the yard, they're writing all this down, and they're like, are you sure? And they're like, yep, we saw it with our own eyes, we even have film of it. And the next thing you know, this story goes out on the front page of the New York Times, the front page of the LA Times, and most significantly, I think, it went out over the AP, which meant that every small town newspaper in America had the headline, and believe me, I know, that was a thankless task, looking at the Holland Sentinel and all that. Barbaric prisoners slash throats of helpless guards, da 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 da. And you could just feel the wave of the shift of change in what people think about prisoner rights. The headlines are rampant, calling for the death penalty again, the telegrams are flooding into the prison, all the newspaper outlets. Now, just pause here again, let's go back into the prison. So, the retaking was just the beginning. What's going on in the prison, while these stories are going out over the wire, is the most unimaginable torture you have ever heard. It goes on for days and weeks. These men are stripped. They are forced to run a gauntlet. These are men who the National Guard is, believe it or not, the National Guard are the heroes of this story. They're trying to get in as medics, and they're being prevented from rendering medical care because the guards are basically, if someone's trying to get in, they'll kick them off the stretcher. They're urinating in open wounds. I mean, you just cannot imagine this brutality. It's all racialized, too. But the American people don't hear any of this. None of it. And as this tide is turning on the outside, that people are becoming more and more hostile to all of it. You know, this isn't a prisoner rights rebellion. These are animals. This isn't civil rights. This is anarchy, right? As this is going on, these guys are being tortured. Meanwhile, of course, there is an incredible movement on the left that doesn't believe any of this, to show up every day, to descend on this prison, to bang on the door, to make sure they get in, to make sure that there's lawyers for these guys, to make sure that they don't get fully railroaded. And in fact, the state, remember, state troopers have murdered 39 people and shot 128 people. And the state goes after the prisoners. It indicts 62 of them. And for the next 5 years, right, everyone that's already read that they've slashed the throats of hostages, for the next 5 years, they watch nothing but black and brown prisoners paraded before the nightly news, standing trial for all of these crimes at Attica that the troopers committed. Now, just as an aside, that's what I meant by cover-up. We now know, one of my great documents I found, was that these troopers are not only protected, but in the few weeks after Attica, the governor has a series of meetings, secret meetings, and I kid you not, in his pool house, where they all get their stories straight. And I found that document. And so these guys are protected. They're fully protected. Not one trooper ends up getting indicted. Not one trooper is held responsible for this. But meanwhile, these guys are all put on trial. And the most amazing thing is this movement on the left to defend these guys. It is the most incredible legal defense effort in American history, I can tell you. It riot the Scottsboro Boys. I mean, this is up there. In fact, it's quickly becoming a case study in a lot of law schools about the importance of grassroots activism as an accompaniment to legal strategy. The strategy in the courtroom was political. It was not just to use the law. It was about talking to the community. It was about drumming up community support. It was about showing up every day in that courtroom, flooding the courtroom with people. It was about making sure that the media told the story the way the story was really happening. It was an incredible story. That's about a third of the book right there. It's just the whole legal story. And at the end of the day, because the prisoners don't go away, and by the way, the guards don't either. The guards, they're another big part of the story, because again, remember, these are working class people that have no power themselves, and They've lost husbands, brothers, sons, and what the state does to them, they're grieving, they're trying to bury their loved ones, or they're trying to survive at the hospital to heal, and the state shows up at their houses and basically says, for example, to Mrs. Cunningham, Mrs. Cunningham has 8 children. Her husband's just been shot to death with shotgun. They come in with shotgun pellets, which has 50-yard spray. So just imagine how many people are wounded. And they tell Mrs. Cunningham, you know, we feel so bad, this is terrible, but all those brutal prisoners that killed, you know, everybody, but here's a little check to tide you over. And Mrs. Cunningham needs that check because she's got 8 children. And her husband is the main breadwinner. So every one of those widows and survivors cashes those checks, except for one. And when they cash those checks, under New York state law, they had quote-unquote elected a remedy, which meant under workman's comp law, they could not sue their employer for the deaths of their husbands. And I found the evidence in the book that shows that that was a deliberate strategy to swindle the guards. So this is a story, by the end of it, the guards, the prisoners stick out. They had one of the most incredible civil suits against the state because they were never believed. In fact, the state always maintained you weren't tortured. It was just a fraternity hazing. In 2000, they finally get a settlement with the state, and they'll tell you to this day that it wasn't justice, but it was the closest thing to justice they were ever going to get. And the guards also finally take on the state, and they can't sue the state, so they basically have to shame the state into a settlement. And they are able to do that because if they're going to pay the prisoners, they better pay the guards, right? Although it takes them 6 years to do that. And there's some remarkable stories here, like Dee Quinn Miller, who is the daughter of the slain guard. Remember the guy who's trampled in the beginning? One of the reasons her father dies is because the prisoners put him on a mattress and get him out so he can get some medical care. And they just leave him there. I mean, the guards, they just leave him there. They don't take him to the hospital. But for years, you know, she hated prisoners. This was all about hating the prisoners. And finally, in about 2000, she met the men who carried her father out. This is a kind of extraordinary story of people coming together, and some of them never came together. Their racial politics made that impossible. But it's really a story about prisoner rebellion as much as a story about repression, which leads me to my last comment so we can open this up. So, the legacy of Attica is deeply, deeply complicated. On the one hand, in the wake of Attica, because of the lies told at Attica, we build the most repressive prison system. We'd already started, but we became, as a nation, the most punitive nation in the world. We are a nation that in the state of Michigan, we have 400 children locked up for life sentences without the possibility of parole, which just got overturned by the Supreme Court, but they still are going to be locked up for life. Pennsylvania, almost 400. How do we explain the punitiveness? I think Attica goes a long way, because Attica is not just Attica, right? It was also Kent State, and the lies told at Kent State. It was also Chicago 68. Somehow, in the 60s and the 70s, the preponderance of the violence in the 60s and 70s was state violence. And yet, we come out of that period believing that anti-war protesters are violent, blacks are violent, civil rights activists are violent, Native Americans are violent. And there's always been a pushback. After Attica, when all those guys were indicted at the National Lawyers Guild Convention, they sat up in front of it and they said a big map of the US. And the president of the Lawyers Guild drew a big line down the map. And he said, all of you to the west of the Mississippi, you're going to Wounded Knee. And all of you to the east of the Mississippi, you're going to Attica. And guess what? They went. And it changed history. I mean, again, the state was never able to formally sentence. I mean, they all got off, basically, is the long story, because of this Herculean effort to take the state on. So that's, you know, on the one hand, we got it all wrong. And the getting it all wrong has been enormously costly. Attica today is worse in 70 than today than it was in 71. I've been in there. It's a hellhole. It's awful. There's more deaths in custody. More horrific things are going on in this nation's prisons than you can even imagine. On the other hand, my book came out in September of 2006. And on September 9th, 2016. That's how old I feel after doing this work. 2016. And when this book came out, It was on the 45th anniversary of Attica, and on that day, many of you know, about 40,000 people behind bars initiated some form of protest. Some of them was a work stoppage, some of it was just a sitting down, some of it was an absolute eruption of anger and frustration. And ever since then, there have been multiple prison uprisings, and some of them you may know about, some of them you may not. Because like what was the case before, these things happen. We only know about them rarely if there happens to be some local media attention and somehow it happens to go national, or you happen to know activists on the ground who are doing prison work. But this stuff is happening all the time. And in addition to being a historian, I spend a lot of time doing prison activism, solidarity work on the ground, trying to shine the light on this, trying to give attention to this, trying to tell these stories. And I will leave you with really where we are today, because I think there's going to be a whole lot more prisoner uprisings probably this September, although I think they're certainly being planned. Whether it's going to happen, it's interesting. I'm not sure, and here's why. Some of you may have noticed that in last April, only a few months ago, there was a major prison riot in South Carolina. And it was newsworthy because in this prison riot, 7 prisoners were killed. They were stabbed to death. So this doesn't fall into the easy category of Attica, right? This is not some everyone goes out to the yard and, you know, like this and, you know, no, this is ugly. This is ugly, ugly, ugly. And when this happened, I'm just watching this, and this was after I'd already, there'd been another one at Vaughn Prison, and I was feeling kind of sick because every time this happens, there may be a little bit of a media blip, but where is everybody? Where is everybody? Where is the people knocking on the, because I know that the worst shit happens after that prison is retaken, because that's what Attica teaches us, if it doesn't teach us anything else, is that the real nightmare begins the minute that control is resumed at that facility. So South Carolina happens, I don't know much, but I know one thing, which is that that is a hellhole of a prison system, that it has been constant lawsuits filed against that prison system. It's particularly barbaric. And if things went wrong, there is a story there, and it's not about prisoner brutality, so we need to know what that story is. So that morning, I got on a plane, I flew to New York, and I was on Democracy Now! That night, and I didn't know much. All I knew was there's a story here, we need to pay attention to it, we need to show up, these people need lawyers, they need eyes on this, what the hell is going on? That's all I knew. And as a result of being on Democracy Now!, all of a sudden, and one of the issues at South Carolina was the state kept saying the reason why this happened was gang warfare. And the issue was cell phones, because in South Carolina, the prisoners all have cell phones. And it was a fight over cell phones. And again, like, you just know enough, it's like, no, what's happening here, right? But I didn't know what. Being on Democracy Now! Connected me with all kinds of guys. I got a shout. connected me with all kinds of people on the inside who were texting me and calling me. So I did a piece in the New York Times on this to bring some attention to it. Okay, whatever. The point is, this was the most brutal prison you'd ever seen, and one of the reasons why this ended up happening was because the guards were basically AWOL. So guys are sending me video footage of this horrible thing happening. And you can see these guys being stabbed. There's not a guard in sight. And after the violence happens, the other prisoners are out there trying to get these guys medical care, calling for guards, calling for help, calling for medics. Nobody's coming. The guards don't show up for 7 hours. The fact that only 7 people died is itself a miracle. And the fact that more didn't die is down to the prisoners rendering the medical care that they did. Why am I telling you this? Because since April, these guys have been locked down. They have not been out of their cell. The entire system is locked down, by the way. This happened at Lee Correctional Facility. And since I wrote that article, which is a piss poor way of offering support, but it was the best thing I could think of because you can't get inside, I met this young woman. She was a vet in South Carolina that was also a lawyer and decided she was so moved by this story that she has been going into South Carolina trying to render some legal aid to these guys. And it is a nightmare. One of the guys she was trying to talk to was a paraplegic elderly man, and when she finally got to him and he was rolled out to her, I mean, when I tell you these guys have been locked down, that means they've been in a 5x7 cell since April. They're being fed through a slot, cold, freezing food. I've seen pictures of it. They've sent me pictures. Dropped in their cell when they feel like it. Sometimes they don't eat till 3 in the afternoon, 4 in the afternoon. Sometimes they don't eat at all. Nobody's watching this. They bring this guy to her, and he is in a wheelchair, and he has Depends undergarments on that he's had on for a month. And he is so afraid to talk to her because the guard's looking at him that he is shaking. And she can't even basically get a statement out of him. So that's what we're talking about now. And so right now, as we're talking about right this moment, we are trying to get eyes on this. We're trying to get people down there. If you follow me on Twitter, you know that's been all I do lately. But guess what? We don't have a Justice Department anymore. We don't have really a Civil Rights Division anymore. I mean, there are still some good people there, and we are trying to get some eyes on this. But I leave you with that very depressing thing, not to depress you, but to remember Attica, which is that when people are treated inhumanely, they will rise up to demand to be treated as human. And when they do, it is our responsibility on the outside to stand with them. And what does it mean to stand with them? Seriously, it doesn't mean much. Doesn't cost a lot. It just means eyes on what is happening, because we have enough of a mythology about our criminal justice system in this nation that even though all unimaginable abuse is going on, people don't want to admit it and they don't want to acknowledge it, and they tend to stop it when people are watching them do it. And they tend to back off a little bit when there is a little bit of eyes on the problem. So South Carolina is just one example. Wherever you live, there is going to be one in your area soon, because people can't be locked down this way and treated this way and kept in these conditions for this long without there being another Attica brewing. And the problem with this moment, unlike Attica, is that we don't have that kind of person necessarily up at the front of the room saying, everybody to the south of Chicago, you're going to South Carolina. Everybody north of Chicago, you're going to New Jersey, right? And that's costing people a great deal. So I just end this by saying, you know, I think that part of the obligation of activists is to get involved with prisoner rights, not because it's sexy, although people think it is for some really twisted reason. Meaning that this is the hip cause or something. No, that's not the reason why. It's because there is no group in our society who is absolutely under the biggest control of the state, with absolutely no recourse other than their own individual brave responses in the moment. And short of literally being willing to die for this, which many people have done and are, in order for it to be actually changing in a movement, it's got to take people on the outside too. And who are we talking about? We're not talking about just prisoners. I've used that term deliberately because I've used it as an abstraction, because I want to end by saying that's not who we're talking about, right? Because if we're all honest, we're really talking about our mothers, our brothers, our sisters, our nieces, our nephews. And if they're not ours, meaning ours personally, that is by the grace of God, it means that somebody had enough money for a good lawyer. It means that somebody's addiction did not lend them behind bars. It means that somebody had the resources to prevent them from being there too. So really, what we're all talking about is not prisoners. We're talking about our people. So thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.